Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fies, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we got a train a coming. It's coming around the bend. Well, no, it's actually already came around. It already came around the bend. And a bunch of guys, really good.
We're a long way from Folsom Prison.
That is true. That is true. Mm-hmm. So I really admire the traction level of their shoes because it's covered with snow. But how
ice, frost, solid ice. Yeah,
it's just, you know, everything you want to not have on top of a moving train when you're stuck on it. Hal, why don't you fill us in on all the stuff that's going on this minute?
A lot of activity, as you said, not a lot of dialogue. All right, minute 84. Steve Rogers, Bucky Barnes, and Gabe Jones race across the roof of the speeding Hydra train, the wind whipping past them in the snowy mountain pass. Steve and Bucky climb down a ladder, slipping into one of the train cars. Inside, crates of weaponry line the shelves. Bucky advances, Thompson machine gun at the ready, his eyes scanning the shadows. Steve moves parallel on the other side, pistol drawn, glancing back at Bucky to ensure he's covered. As Steve steps into the next car, heavy doors slam shut, separating him from Bucky. Through the door's window, Steve sees Bucky spin to face Hydra soldiers, his machine gun blazing as he returns fire. In Steve's car, a towering Hydra soldier levels a cannon-like weapon, its barrel pulsing with blue energy. Steve fires two quick shots from his pistol and dives behind a stack of crates as the soldier unleashes a barrage of energy bolts, splintering the crates. Dr. Arnim Zola, watching on a video monitor, shouts frantically, "Stop him! Fire again!" In the other car, Bucky, pinned down, trades fire with two Hydra soldiers at the far end of the aisle. He nails one, but shots ring out, forcing him to duck behind the shelves, bullets sparking around him. Steve, gripping his shield, exchanges shots with the cannon-wielding soldier, the blue energy bolts scorching the air as he maneuvers for an opening.
Lots, like you said, lots of excitement.
This so is much action.
Pa-cow, pa-cow, yeah.
Yes. Butta, butta, butta.
Yes. I keep wondering, I mean, maybe I'm not in the military and I haven't been in the military, but the use of the machine gun seems to be a little bit too many bullets at a time. it's just you're emptying clip after clip and you don't
also
really
also in a very small metallic space.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. That's a bit of a Hollywood thing. And I will, for the aficionados in the audience, on their behalf, Jim, I'll politely remind you that those are magazines.
Magazines, yes. I'm sorry.
I know you know that.
Yes.
But somebody had to be the pedant here, and I think it was my turn.
That's true. And isn't it pronounced pedant?
Oh, I sit corrected.
I got to tell you guys a joke. When I was in college, I had a roommate and I told him, don't patronize me. And he said, it's pronounced patronize. And it 20 years later, the light bulb went on why that was funny. It just stuck. It annoyed me for years and years and years. And then 20 years later, I'm like, oh, he was joking.
Oh, man.
Or maybe he was just a jerk. I don't know.
That is just fantastic. That just reminded me, there was a former colleague of mine who one day in casual conversation, I used the word doppelganger. That made her really mad because that's complicated and she had no idea what it meant. And she gets all mad, like, what does that even mean? And so I start to explain it. And he goes, I don't even care. It's just, I just don't have a very big whatever. And I said, is the word you can't think of vocabulary? By any chance? That she was just furious and stormed off. And I thought, wow, your vocabulary is so small, it doesn't include the word vocabulary. There's some sort of fascinating symmetry there to me.
Oh, boy. Well, this, yes. I have to say, this is Toby Jones at his best. I love the way when nobody else is in charge, he's in charge. That's
right.
But he's so useless. What kind of tactical orders are these? Stop him, fire again? Like the guy wouldn't have thought of that?
Yeah, it's like, my trigger finger still works. Oh,
well, let me just stand aside and let Captain America walk through. It hadn't occurred to me to try to stop him.
Oh, That's no, Zola, you guys Zola are no both soldier. So right.
Yeah.
I mean, Zola is wanting to do something. You know, obviously he's not going to be out there in the thick of it. He's wanting to do something and he's trying to be in charge. But as you said, it's not exactly brilliant tactical advice.
He's panicking real quickly here.
Yeah.
And probably appropriately.
I have to ask about the thing that's behind him. Is the engine, is the locomotive running on blue godlike energy power? Is that what's in front of him?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, there is. It looks like a whole, I don't know, panel or console full of, it almost looks like the CERN collider back there.
Yeah.
The super collider.
But it's like right along blue. The center line of the engine. And it's if he's at the very front, if this is the locomotive, that would almost be like a nose cone.
Yeah,
I think this train must be powered by the blue tesseract.
And if you look at the panels around it, you know, we've always complimented this film on it, how it has such a 1940s feel to the tech, to the set dressing and so forth. But these panels, it looks like the inside of the Millennium Falcon there or something. It's definitely more sci-fi than what we've seen of 1940s super tech in the past.
Yeah, I like all the joysticks that are sticking out of the walls next to the monitors, which I'm assuming that's how he can control the cameras, but they all seem to be practical in their, you know, in their, it's not just random buttons and blinky lights. Well, there's a lot of blinky lights. Yeah, but I do like the idea that, well, maybe he wants to turn the camera around and see how his henchmen are doing out there. I guess they're not his henchmen, they're Red Skull's henchmen. But being able to track on the progress as if he's expecting a fight. That's the other part of this. It's like, well, I'm probably going to get attacked somewhere along the way.
So we're going to keep this really, really secure.
Yeah. I'm looking at behind Zola now. It looks like there's a whole circle of what I take to be pressure gauges. Like I see four of them.
Yeah.
In a circle around there. Like there's a lot of pressure going through this thing, whatever it is. One might think in terms of, all right, the blue glow is creating heat, which creates steam or something like that. Maybe it's a steam engine. I don't know.
It's apparently very humid or something because there's a lot of that volumetric light chasing itself out of the tesseract well or whatever. The pool.
The well of souls.
Yes. But
I think you're absolutely right, Jim. I don't think there's any other explanation. What else would this train need?
What else would it be? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not an active weapon up there or anything.
Right.
Yeah. And all this stuff was sitting around waiting for, Zola had already designed early minutes and minutes and minutes ago. We were talking about Zola designing all these weapons and materials that could run on tesseract power. So somehow he knew how to manage that and how to put it into play. And I would love I guess there's no point in it, but I would love a prequel explaining how Zola came up with the theories of what he was going to power all of these devices that he had designed.
And how to mine all that energy from the tesseract itself. It's a little cube. It's, you know, 6 by 6 by 6 inches or something like that. And somehow they've sucked enough energy out of it to power this train, to power thousands of weapons, to power all these aircraft, all these things are going to have later on. It seems to be a source of infinite power, which is as advertised.
Yeah.
Well, then there must be tesseract batteries or something, as you said, to go into the weapons.
Yeah. That one Cap stole back.
Oh,
back,
right. Yeah.
Back that's, in the day. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah, the little cartridges or canisters or whatever they are. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to go in a different direction, but I've got to say that when I saw Cap, Bucky, and Gabe Jones on top of the train, aside from worrying about their traction, my first thought was that Gabe was a goner, that Gabe was cannon fodder. So it's like the old Star Trek joke of, you know, Kirk, Spock, Bones, and Ensign Ricky beamed down to the planet.
Yeah.
Who's not coming back?
Right. Well, who's in red?
Yeah. And I know the history of Bucky. I figured that this is probably what was, you know, this is probably Bucky's moment. But man, I was worried about Gabe the whole time.
Yeah,
and well, we can't. His later exploits come up in a minute or two, so we're going to see a little bit more of Gabe shortly. And Gabe has, I'm trying to figure out what tubes he has on his. There's a brief scene of him. He's on one knee on top of around second 12, and he's got his Thompson out, and on his over his right pocket, he's got three little tubes, and they remind me of, I just got back from the Jamestown Colony up near Colonial Williamsburg, and they have reenactors or interpreters, I think is what they call it, that show you how musketeers were in the 1600s, and those look like the preloaded what you'd wear on a bandolier that it had the appropriately sized amount of black powder that you needed to pour into a musket. So it's just I don't think that Thompson needs that kind of pouring, but they look very similar. I just couldn't figure out what else it might be. Some kind of like weird grenade maybe, or it's
I kind of took it to be shotgun shells, but of course he's not wielding a shotgun. He doesn't have a shotgun, so yeah. I don't know. I while we're looking at this minute or the second 12 or 13 here in this clip, I've got to say Gabe Jones is showing some excellent excellent trigger discipline.
Yeah, Hal, you're on mute, by the way.
Yeah, he is. That's a great point, Brian. He's what he's indexing, and which is the finger is pointed. It's outside the trigger guard. It's off the trigger, and it's just pointed straight ahead until you're ready to shoot. And that is a nice touch, and that tells me that either the actor maybe has done some shooting, or presumably and hopefully the onset armorer had some very strict rules, because that's one of those things that you just flat out do not mess around with.
Yeah, when you watch old James Bond movies, it's like, why do you have your finger on the trigger?
Right. Yeah, constantly. And even the beginning of a very different version of The Avengers, no relation, but one of my favorite British cult classic TV shows of Steed and Mrs. Peel. There's a scene in probably the 67 season, because it was in color, at Diana Rigg. And she's got her little gold-plated revolver and thing, finger on the trigger, and then she lifts it up and uses the barrel to brush away a lock of hair.
Yeah,
and it's oh my gosh, you're wonderful, but boy, don't.
Yeah, that's Plan 9 from Outer Space level of oops. Yeah,
yes, exactly. But with better dialogue, much better dialogue.
Yes, the other topic that I wanted to get into that most of this particular minute is them marching around waiting for trouble. But I can't help but notice the architecture in the interior of this train is almost completely corrugated, which is it's a nice touch. It gives you that, it gives you very Death Star feel about things, I think. But it's, if you're going to find a theme for this minute, I would look at the massive corrugation of this whole interior. That's very, it makes you think of Quonset huts and all kinds of stuff. Right. And Brian, as you write a weekly essay about different topics, and one of the things you were talking about today was earthquakes and waves, like everything's made out of waves, which you could also say particles, but maybe waves. we'll go with waves.
And we can arm wrestle for it.
Yeah, okay.
I think we've had that discussion before, or perhaps it's in an upcoming minute, but we've talked particles and waves.
Yeah. So but
we're just that smart.
But getting, yeah, welcome to another physics minute. But the thing that I always knew about corrugation, I had a teacher back in the seventh grade who showed how you could make something stronger by bending it back and forth and making these waves, and you could put like heavy books on top of a piece of corrugated paper instead of you'd go from to fan fold and then to corrugation. But corrugation as an idea in architecture comes back from the 1820s. There was a fellow, according to my research, 1829, a fellow named Henry Palmer, engineer and architect for the London Dock Company, got a British patent for indented or corrugated metallic sheets applied to buildings. So he's the guy that came up with, he needed a lightweight but a strong material to roof new warehouses at the docks in London. So he figured out that flat iron sheets were too flexible for those big wide spans that they had to cover over the timbers, but passing them through fluted rollers, they were he had these big, basically it looked like rolling pins, and you had you were alternating top bottom, and then you fed a piece of flat metal through the rollers, and it would come out corrugated on the other side, and that would, and those little corrugations, those little waves would make tiny little arches, like in architectural arches, and it would increase the bending strength, so it wouldn't twist, and it wouldn't collapse on the edges. So in 1830, Palmer demonstrated his invention with a large open-sided rectangular shed at the London docks. And he showed that you could make this span 40 feet long without any kind of internal support. So you could save on lumber, and you could use the cheapest metal you could find and just make these gigantic roofs without having to worry about a lot of internal support. The fewer pillars or posts that you needed inside of a warehouse, the more room you had for your hogsheads and barrels to, you know, to load up on your cutty sarks and things. So corrugation, because of this thing, became a craze, and all of a sudden they started using it all over England. And then it's, of course, you know, being in the British Empire, it spread to Australia and then New Zealand. And there's, I mean, we in America, we have a lot of, you know, like we have the Quonset huts and things like that. But in England and Australia, the standard became use corrugated metal wherever you can. So there's a lot of like where we have wooden barns and things, a lot in New Zealand, most of the barns are made out of corrugated metal, which is something I didn't know. Yes, Brian.
Yes, Brian.
Jim, you in the back.
You in the back.
I'm reminded, and I don't mean to, something a little orthogonal is that you reminded me that Thomas Jefferson designed serpentine, or it's called crinkle crankle walls at the University of Virginia.
That's right.
Because he noted that if you build a straight wall, a breeze or something can knock a straight brick wall over very easily. If you curve it, you can actually make a stronger wall and use fewer bricks because you don't need the bricks to be double thick. You could put a single brick wide wall if you curve it, serpentine it. And it's just a really neat solution to an engineering problem that also happens to look great. It's very elegant. But Thomas Jefferson came up with that.
Yeah.
Crinkle, crinkle.
Yeah.
I knew about it, and the picture, the types of brick fences you're talking about, but I've never heard crinkle crankle until just now, and I believe you're not making that up.
Oh, I'm looking right at the web right now. And would the internet steer us wrong?
Never more than like once a minute. And building on that same thing too, in the 20s and 30s. There was a period where metal aircraft versus sort of fabric construction or wooden fabric and things, you start seeing metal skinned aircraft. And at the beginning, you know, trying to figure out how thick does the skin have to be to make it strong enough, but it can't be too thick, it can't be too heavy, as in aviation, especially when you're talking about transport aircraft, you know, everything is about weight. And it's always also, there's always also a trade-off. So you had Junkers in Germany doing a series of things, probably the most famous example being the Ju-52, using a tri-motor transport, dropping paratroopers during World War II. So that had that heavy corrugated skin, or that heavy looking corrugated skin, but they were doing small single engine airplanes for quite a while. And then the Stout Motor Company, Stout Aircraft Company, excuse me, in the U.S., which was bought out by Henry Ford, they were building airplanes that then evolved into the 20s era Ford Trimotor. And it uses that same concept. It's that same idea. You can have a thinner aluminum that needs fewer stringers or formers on the inside and make a strong fuselage without going crazy with weight. The big downside in aviation, though, is aerodynamics. You know, all those ripples cause a lot of drag. So you've got a trimotor, a Ford trimotor, remarkable big airplane, can, you know, carry 10 or 12 people less than a quarter century after the Wrights at Kitty Hawk. And now you have what we would recognize today as a modern metal airliner of sorts, semi-modern. That airplane, and I'm lucky enough to have flown one a few times, that airplane does everything at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Like, just doesn't really matter, you know, what you want to do. And for such a big airplane, you can't imagine how ridiculously slow that feels, but it's big and heavy, but it also, it was the right airplane at the right time, because that sturdiness of construction, if people had seen barnstormers flying World War I Curtis Jennys with their fabric and things like that. That looks sort of flimsy and stuff. And a Ford Trimotor in the US or a Junkers airliner in Germany comes along and says, well, that's serious and strong. I can probably trust that. And, you know, so those airplanes were pivotal in getting people one step closer to being acclimated to this whole idea of air travel.
They are quite an experience to be inside. I mean, I think their cruise altitude is something like 2,000 feet, and
right.
they give or take 50 feet at any given second. So yeah. It's just it's very much a corrugated ride,
and so sedate. In the earliest days, I don't want to monopolize, but the very earliest days of the heyday of the trimotors. The Transcontinental Air Service, you could buy a ticket to go coast to coast, but you would go in the airplane by day. That would take you, you know, some, maybe it's a third of the way across, and you'd get on a train, ride the train overnight, and then get at the next stop, get on another trimotor. And I think there may have been even one more overnight involved. So you're buying one ticket, you're on three different airplanes, two or three different trains, and it's taking a while. But people were doing that at least could have been alive when that trip took 6 months in a covered wagon. So
yeah,
pretty incredible. Yeah.
It's something to see. I can strongly recommend if you do get a chance to see one of EAA's traveling trimotors, it is worth taking an excursion on it just to get the feel of what you can appreciate in modern jet aircraft. one of the big features when I think in America, the thing, when we think of corrugated metal, we think of Quonset huts. And we think, oh, the Quonset hut was a pioneering thing, but actually it was derived from something called the Neeson hut, which was a British invention from World War I. It was created by a guy named Colonel Neeson around like middle of the war, 1916. And it had a similar arched corrugated metal structure so that you could build it. But in 1941, the U.S. prepared for potential involvement with World War II. So the Navy started looking for a lightweight, all-purpose, portable building they could carry on ships, put it together with unskilled labor. You know, you give somebody two wrenches, one guy on the inside, one guy on the outside, and you could put it together and could withstand various climates without needing a concrete foundation. So you just drop it on the ground, boom, it's ready. So the Navy contracted the George Fuller Company to develop and manufacture the huts. They started the effort. I used to live near this place. They started the effort at Quonset Point up in Rhode Island, up near Newport. And the first prototype was produced about 60 days after they got the contract. The early versions used corrugated steel sheets for the sides. It had plywood ends, a pressed wood liner for the bottom of it, and then they put a wooden floor on top. And they estimated you could put the whole thing together in an 8-hour day. So,
well, and I don't know about you guys, but at least in my town, we've still got some World War II Quonset huts that are serving as functioning businesses. They're indestructible. The only thing that takes them out is rust. But if you can prevent corrosion, they'll last forever.
Yeah, well, we've got a few on our big air show convention grounds here in Oshkosh.
Of course you do.
During,
as you said, they'll last forever.
And during the war, they figured out that if you anodize, you know, you anodize the steel, it won't rust as fast. So it's easy to keep these things going for a century. Just go out there and get some Bondo to fix up the holes. The real popularity, I mean, why you see them everywhere is after World War II, we had all these huts coming back from the European and Pacific theaters. And the Navy was like, you want it, you can have it for here's $5 to go take it away. And exactly. they were repurposing homes, barns, whatever. You still see them, like you said, today.
But it was really interesting to have read, you know, so much, like particularly about, you know, British military stuff, British military aviation as a kid. And so I was familiar with the term. I think in my head, I was pronouncing it Nissen huts. I was never quite sure. I've never heard it spoken aloud until you said it, actually, funnily enough. And in my mind, that's, you know, an equivalent of a Quonset hut. But I never bothered to dive in and say which actually came first. And that's really interesting. So I wonder if Mr. Nissen or Neeson knew our friend Shrapnel.
Ooh,
and as you related to Liam.
Yeah.
Maybe it's Liam's great granddad or something.
Oh, it's with the E or with the A. That's
right. Where
the,
yeah. How many more huts could I have built?
Or maybe the ramen company. I'm not sure.
He's got a particular set of skills. Building huts. That's his skill.
Yes.
Wow. So now I keep this. I would like. I keep thinking. Oh, gee, if I really wanted, I could just put a Quonset hut in my backyard. But I think the only problem with a Quonset hut is it doesn't. The arch kind of limits the amount of stuff you can put in it. I mean, you want something. I mean, this is great for something fast that's sturdy. But I think you still want a square frame just for volume.
You know, we've got famous
pictures.
We've got a famous Quonset hut here in Sonoma County, California. Hal will probably remember this from the movie It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. An aircraft flies through basically a Quonset hut, but used as an airplane hangar. That still exists here at the Sonoma County Airport.
Wow.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You can watch the movie, and so much has changed around that hut, but you can see the line of the hills behind it. It's just a signature piece.
I haven't watched that movie in ages.
Trying to get used to no CGI, that really was that was a Beach Twin, was it? I can't remember.
Yeah, Beach 18.
Yeah,
which we have talked about on this show.
That's right. Yeah. So, it's an amazing scene to see, and hopefully it was one take because I just trying to. clearance. Yeah. That's about all I know about Quonset huts.
Is there any more blood left in this stone?
We've all learned something today.
We all.
I'll take this away and I'm going to use it in the future. This is good stuff.
We've all learned something and we've all taught something.
Yes. Yeah. Try to use the word Quonset in a sentence at least once today, please.
And extra points if you can work in doppelganger.
Yes. Wow. Well, again, thanks everybody for joining us on this particular episode. If you'd like to continue this conversation, you know how we would. We're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe. Please leave a like at the podcast. Let me try this again. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.